Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Helping create the infrastructure for the global hydrogen economy at airproducts.com/fuelcells.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Imam Siraj Wahaj is one of the most visible leaders among America's 6 million Muslims today. He was the first ever Muslim to lead a prayer before the start of a session of Congress. But this American imam is hardly a guardian of the status quo. He has called the FBI and CIA the real terrorists and predicted an Islamic future for the United States. The one-time Baptist who was born Jeffrey Kearse left the church after Martin Luther King's assassination to join the Black Muslim movement. His journey took him on to Orthodox Islam and Saudi Arabia. Today, he is an outspoken crossover figure in America's Muslim communities who attracts both African American and immigrant followers. Tonight on Point, Imam Siraj Wahaj and Islam in America. Earlier today, I spoke with Wall Street Journal reporter and editor Paul Barrett, who recently described the imam as an Islamic American star on the journal's front page. I asked him what makes Imam Wahaj a star.
He's a star in the sense that he is one of the most popular Muslim preachers across the country. And this goes not only among African American Muslims, but also among immigrant Muslims and second generation immigrant Muslims. You see an advertisement for a major Islamic conference, it's a pretty good bet that he'll be one of the main speakers there.
And this goes right across lines of ethnicity, race, background, country of origin.
That's right. And in that regard, he is very, very unusual, verging on unique. You don't see a lot of crossover in terms of Black Muslim clerics giving talks in predominantly immigrant mosques.
And a star, you say, in a burgeoning world of Islam. What's the evidence of the burgeoning you describe?
Well, immigration of Muslims has increased markedly over the years, somewhat damped by September 11th. Black conversion to Islam has been continuing and expanding in numbers.
And standing prominently within that context is Imam Siraj Wahaj. Can you give us just the thumbnail biography of this man?
He grew up in Brooklyn in a public housing project. He received a partial scholarship to go to NYU, New York University.
He was raised Baptist.
He was raised as a Baptist and, in fact, was a very regular attendee at church.
And was a great admirer of Martin Luther King in his
youth. He was a great admirer of Martin Luther King, and as he recounts his personal history, was, like many African-American men of his age, and he's now in his early 50s, was very personally wounded by the assassination of Dr. King and felt that that event pushed him toward a choice between political militancy or religious-tinged militancy, and he chose the latter and joined the Nation of Islam, which at that time, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, was really the main option if someone was interested in Islam.
But in 1975, when Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the Nation of Islam, died,
he left. In many ways, Nation of Islam, you know, was or became a personality cult, and when the central figure died, that was a very unsettling experience for people who were a part of the sect, and thousands of them left and began migrating in one way or another over toward more orthodox Islam. In other words, Islam as practiced in the Middle East and other predominantly Muslim countries, and he was one of those. And very strikingly and interestingly, he received training both in this country and in Saudi Arabia from Saudi-backed organizations. And having gone through that training, he eventually formed his own congregation and started a mosque in Bedford-Stuyvesant in central Brooklyn, which was and really still is a very poor and in many ways troubled neighborhood. And his mosque pretty quickly became a focal point for religious activity, various types of cultural activity, anti-drug activity. He led members of his mosque in chasing crack dealers from the neighborhood in the late 1980s and got a certain amount of local acclaim for that.
And ultimately, national acclaim as well. In 1991, right. He was the first Muslim ever to lead a prayer before a start of a session of the House
exactly.
of Representatives.
That reflected his popularity as a speaker, because all along he mm-hmm. began traveling the country, speaking to conferences and at fundraisers and so forth.
Also dined with Madeleine Albright to break a Ramadan fast. So he's moved in high circles there.
Yes.
But in the 90s, there was also this tinge of association with Islamic militism around his mosque.
In the early and mid-90s, when, as it's now since become clear, there was a very powerfully militant and very anti-American set of organizing activity in various mosques in the New York, New Jersey area, his mosque was one where at least some of the people involved in that activity appeared. And as a result, when some of those people were prosecuted in the mid-90s in connection with the so-called Landmarks conspiracy case, that was the case in which the Egyptian cleric known as the Blind Sheikh.
Sheikh Abdul Rahman.
Exactly. They were prosecuted growing out of the first World Trade Center bombing case. And ultimately, the Sheikh, who had spoken on one occasion in Imam Wahaj's mosque, and several other people who he had either met or who had attended the mosque were convicted.
But there were no charges whatsoever against the Imam Wahaj.
No charges were ever brought against him, but his name was mentioned at one point in a document circulated by the U.S. Attorney's Office here in New York. And as a result of his name being mentioned there, along with, it's important to say, 170 other people, but Imam Wahaj, he was never indicted, and that's very important to emphasize.
What's the message that Imam Wahaj delivers on the stump today?
It ranges from basically analysis of the Quran in very traditional form. At other times, he talks about following Islamic dictates like avoiding alcohol, drugs, pornography, and so forth. But at other times, he stresses themes that are a little bit more unsettling probably to non-Muslim ears, having to do with decadence that he sees in American society, preference for a system that would be governed by Islamic law, which by American standards is often very harsh. And he also discusses American society in a way that makes it very clear that he's very, very skeptical of the American government.
Paul, when the Wall Street Journal puts a story, a big story, on Imam Wahaj on page one, what is the implication there then?
The implication is more general and basic, that we think that this is an important and interesting story. When you say African Americans and Islam, most people even today will still think of the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan, and people in neat Western-style suits and bow ties, whereas the Nation of Islam, as it's known to most people, has been completely eclipsed by the brand of Islam that Imam Wahaj practices, more orthodox Sunni Islam. And to understand this man, to understand the journey he has traveled, both spiritually, politically, and otherwise, is something that would give people insight into the African-American community and into the Muslim community.
Paul Barrett, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Paul Barrett is a reporter and editor at the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us from New York. We're talking tonight with American Imam Siraj Wahaj. You can join the conversation. What is the future of Islam in America? What do you hear in the messages of Imam Wahaj? Does the Imam speak to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York, is Imam Siraj Wahaj, who first gained national recognition for leading a successful anti-drug campaign in the Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood of Brooklyn in the 1980s. Good evening and welcome, Imam Siraj Wahaj.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
There's a lot we want to learn from you tonight. We're grateful to you for coming on. And I guess the first question that our conversation with Paul Barrett, I think you just heard part of it, raises.
Yeah, just part of it, yeah.
He talks about Orthodox Islam eclipsing the Nation of Islam, or what many Americans may think of as the Black Muslim movement in America, in recent years. Do you share that view? Is that happening? Are American Muslims, Black and otherwise, turning to more Orthodox Islam?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. As you know, I was once a minister in the Nation of Islam under the teachings of Elijah Muhammad, similar to Malcolm X, Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz. And during especially the 60s and the 70s, you saw a tremendous growth in that organization. Perhaps now this group, headed by Minister Louis Farrakhan out of Chicago, at best maybe 50,000 followers. and you're talking about the Orthodox Muslims, you're probably approaching between 6 and 7 million.
In
the United States.
In the United States. And and about 1 million of those would be, what, from an African-American tradition?
Most people estimate about one-third of that number would be African-Americans. In fact, and it's interesting, a number of them have actually come from the movement of the Nation of Islam, people like Wallace D. Muhammad, who was the son of Elijah Muhammad, who led his father's former community toward Orthodox Islam, and our brother Muhammad Ali, formerly Cassius Clay, is now an Orthodox Muslim.
Imam Wahaj, we want to hear about your own journey from the Nation of Islam to Orthodox Islam this evening, but let's get right to the nub of this question that comes up here, if we could first.
Yeah, sure.
On the one hand, you've been you've sat with the high officials in the U.S. government, been in the U.S. Congress, spoken all over this country, widely praised by the police and authorities for your work in the Bedford-Stuyvesant area for cracking down on crime.
Yes.
At the same time, you are an Islamic preacher, and some of what you say in your very widely distributed speeches on videotape and audio tape, as you've seen yourself quoted, you must see, it strikes American ears, some American ears, as threatening, upsetting. For example, you're quoted in the Wall Street Journal story that you no doubt saw, page one, big story, couldn't miss it, saying that that there are elements in the United States government that want the destruction of Islam. Do you believe, I should say, not just the government, you say the government and U.S. media. Do you believe that? And who are you pointing at with that kind of statement?
Well, Let me say this. You know, I've been the brunt of criticism by a number of people, including Daniel Pipes. And you see,
Daniel Pipes, a kind of conservative analyst who's written at some length about the growth of Islam in the United States, and has said it's a danger to American democracy.
Well, let me tell you what he said. And see, he says that he's not blaming Islam, but he's blaming militant Islam. And see, this is the thing that's unsettling to me and to many Muslims. And I'm going to quote what he said, because if you're going to talk about militant Islam, you're going to have to describe it.
All right.
And on page 7 in his book, he says it has three main features. Number one, a devotion to the sacred law. That is the Quran and the traditions of Prophet Muhammad. Number two, a rejection of Western influences. And number three, a turning of faith into ideology. And so I think the point that we're trying to make is that we shouldn't get confused with our dissent with being disloyal to the country. And I want to say this, you know, out front. I am an American citizen. I love this country. And just because I love this country doesn't mean that I can't criticize some aspects of the government. I don't think that all of the American people are against Islam. You have 1,500,000,000 Muslims around the world. One-third of them are non-Muslim countries. So where are they? Not only are they in China and Russia, in Great Britain and France, but you find them in the United States.
Imam,
many of them have migrated to this country because they share the good values of the American people. And I do think that there are some people who Islam now has become the new enemy, much like communism of the past.
You know, tonight we want to get way beyond this notion of whether or not a person can criticize the United States. Of course, that's part of the meaning of a democracy. We want to try and get in more in depth here and really understand where you're coming from.
Okay.
And on that score, what about, just for starters, this notion that the government, the media, are out to destroy Islam?
It's apparent to me, and this is why I quoted that particular passage, is that
the president opens his doors to Islamic leaders. He breaks bread with them. But
I thought that that's fine. Mm-hmm. That's reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But does that not mean that we cannot criticize the policy of our government, for instance?
Absolutely.
Does it not also mean that maybe our government is making some mistakes? And so I think that it is our responsibility to point these mistakes out. As I read, and I read widely,
mm-hmm.
it seems to me that it is a veiled criticism. On the one hand, they say, well, we're not criticizing Islam except for with a few Christian right ministers who are directly saying that Muhammad was an evil man and Islam was an evil religion. We have
Franklin Graham and that
ilk. Exactly. But on the other hand, we have those. Now you got to see how we view it as Muslims. That here, every time we turn around, they're attacking Muslims. Here's Imam Siraj Wahaj, right?
Mm-hmm.
Respected Imam in the Muslim community.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, people want to criticize the ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America. Why? Because Imam Siraj Wahaj, one of his board members, is a terrorist. And so here is, and people know me. People know Imam Siraj and Dr. Mazemmu Siddiqui and all of these other great Muslim leaders, and they know they're not terrorists.
Imam Wahaj, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight with Imam Siraj Wahaj about Islam in America, its growing reach, and its tensions within the American status quo. What do you hear in the message of the Imam? Is America seeing... I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Imam Siraj Wahaj about Islam in America, its growing reach, and its tensions with the American status quo. The Imam has a mosque in the Bed-Stuyvesant district of Brooklyn. He's been very active there in cleaning up the community, pushing out drug dealers, been very prominent in interactions with American government officials, the U.S. Congress, Madeleine Albright, and others. You can join our conversation tonight. American Muslims, does Imam Wahaj speak for you? And what is the future of Islam in America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Imam Wahaj, I want to come back to some of these issues, but I wish you'd tell us first, if you could, just describe in brief your journey from being a young Baptist to joining the Nation of Islam to become a more Orthodox Muslim. What prompted each of these steps?
I think the first one, at first as a Christian, I think was the death of Martin Luther King. When he was assassinated, I know that took something out of me. I loved him, and of course I love my Christian faith. And I think with his death, as a young man searching for freedom and justice for African Americans, I saw that now as maybe along with Martin Luther King's death, the dream died. And I know I made up in my mind to either be a black Muslim or black Panther. And I thought at that time these two groups represented maybe a better opportunity for African Americans rather than to dependent upon white people, that we could do something for ourselves. And hence I joined the Nation of Islam in 1968 as a student at New York University.
And then with the death of Elijah Muhammad, you...
Yeah, I really started studying the Quran for the first time, really studying it. And that led me into the same path of Malcolm X. I was blessed to make pilgrimage to Mecca about five different times. And I really started studying and learning to love the religion for itself. Obviously, there were a lot of flaws in the teachings of the Nation of Islam. And, it had some good impact on African Americans. But always we're searching for truth. We're always searching to make ourselves better. And I want to say this, by the way. I want to say this about Paul Barrett. I thought he did a wonderful job.
The Wall Street Journal reporter,
yes,
big story on
it. It's a big story. You know, he came to our masjid about four different times, and he actually sat there in our sermon. And I think it's good, and I think we should have more of that, because of our interaction with one another, it helped me to crystallize talking to non-Muslims, seeing a non-Muslim sitting and listening to me in my sermon,
mm-hmm.
And it made me say, you know what? Okay, let me rethink that. Maybe some of the rhetoric was a little bit harsh. So I really credit Paul with doing that and opened up some very, very good dialogue. And, you know, and I think that's a good idea, by the way. And I always think that we should sit up at the conference table. And that's a good thing. And I don't want people to think that, you know, I do disagree with Paul's, some of his assessments. And I do not hate Americans and hate the West. There is nothing in the Quran that talks about anti-Westernism, anti-Americanism. In fact, if you study the Quran, you will see that Muslims can marry Christians and Jews. We have a good relationship. So I don't want people to misunderstand that, to think that we are anti-America. That's not true. That's not true at all.
Let's take it out of that very lofty realm and down to some of the things that Paul has culled out of your tapes. For example, your proclamation that the real terrorists are the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the CIA. Did you say it?
I probably said it. I probably did say it. I mean, I said things like that. I mean that I don't think that anyone can say that the hands of the FBI is clean. If we studied the life of Martin Luther King, and you know that the Southern Leadership Conference with Martin Luther King as his head was put on the terrorist list by the FBI. That's nothing new. You know, they have done that, and the CIA and the FBI have been implicated in many things that I would classify as anti-Americanism.
But when you look at 9/11 and the extent of destruction on that day, Does it still stand up? Would you still say that the FBI and CIA are the real terrorists?
Well, I mean, well, what are you saying? I mean,
The destruction seems so enormous, so overwhelming.
Are we saying that's the only destruction that ever happened to anybody on this earth?
That's a fair question.
It was enormous. Certainly was enormous. And I feel bad, not because only American life was lost, but because human life was lost. That's the most important issue. And I think that one of the things that I think that's important to be some dialogue between the American people and others who are even Americans. Are Muslims or Jews or Christians or Buddhists or Sikh, and I think we should have this kind of dialogue. Certainly was a horrible. That was a horrible event. Mm-hmm. But people keep so as if now okay to say what now the Muslims did it, Islam is responsible for it. If some Muslims have done this horrible act, what about all those people who have committed acts of terrorism before in the name of Judaism, in the name of Christianity, in fact, in the name of Islam? It's
wrong. As far as we know, particular Muslims have taken credit for that event on that day. So, I mean, that seems to be pretty firmly established, is it not?
I'm not so sure about that. Well, you know, this is the point, Tom, that was wrong, absolutely wrong. I condemn it. We condemn it. I think all the Muslims that I know condemn it. I think people... extremists like that, our religion teaches against it, is wrong. They ought to be condemned in the very worst way.
So, but you're saying you're not sure that it was Islamist terrorists? You're not sure it was Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden?
You know, I'm not even going to get into that. You know, we have a principle that Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessing be upon him, said, وَلَكِنَ الْبَيْنَ الْمُدَعِي. And that means the burden of the proof is on the one who makes the accusation. If someone makes an accusation, they have to prove it.
But the videotape from bin Laden seemed to take credit.
Why would you want me to get into that? If you're convinced that he did it, if the intelligence community is convinced that he did it, let me tell you how Muslims see it. We look at something that's done often in this country, and that is repetition of it could even be a lie. And you can repeat it so often that it sounds like the truth. And I'm saying I'm not going to get into that. I'm saying that whoever did it is wrong, absolutely. I'm saying that the majority of people that I speak to are not convinced simply because the American government said this one did that and that one did that. I'm just not convinced. We grew up with that program called Mission Impossible, and we saw a lot of things that appeared to be but wasn't necessary as we thought they were.
And that's exactly why I'm asking, because it's an interesting nuance when a leader like yourself has that view. That's interesting.
And, Tom, it's not just me. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Mm-hmm. It's not just me. It is not just 6 million Muslims in America. Mm. And I'm telling you, are you talking about people around the world are very skeptical about some things that this government has done?
Let me ask you, if I may, Imam, about Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. Many Americans know him as the blind Egyptian cleric who was convicted in the case around the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
He has attended your mosque, and you've been laudatory of him. You testified. Didn't you testify in his defense?
Laudatory, okay. He came to our masjid once. He gave a talk. He was very well known, very well respected.
Yeah.
The context of me praising him was that, before the conviction. Sheikh Abdurrahman was known as one beautiful reciter of the Quran, understanding of the religion. And, I must admit it, it's in the article, that he when he came to our masjid, I'm telling you something about us, Tom. We don't just accept you because you call yourself a Muslim or even call yourself a Muslim scholar. Mm-hmm. We're going to judge you by the light of the Quran and by our Prophet Muhammad. Now, when Sheikh Abdurrahman said something that I thought was wrong and inappropriate, I stopped him and I corrected him. Mm-hmm. And then he kind of laughed and said, yeah, Imam Siraj is right. And so when he suggested that, robbing of banks, something that might be permissible in this society, I said, no, that's ludicrous. That's crazy. And right there, it's documented. So it's not like anything that you do, it's accepted.
Do you believe he was wrongly convicted, Imam Wahash?
I really don't know. I don't know. Because you must admit that, the most American people that I know, when O.J. Simpson was acquitted, most Americans said, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I think he's guilty. So we have that. So we have people that have their judgments. But I'm saying the bigger issue is this. And I really try my best to practice that principle, that when I'm given the information and I try to make the my judgment based upon information given to me, honestly, whether they're Muslim or non-Muslim or black or white or whatever the case may be.
But you're prepared to be a skeptic.
Yes.
Let me ask you then about looking here at the front page of the Wall Street Journal. This will be an arresting quote for many people to read. Of course, you're a religious man, so we want to understand exactly what you mean by it. You say, in time, this so-called democracy will crumble, and there will be nothing, and the only thing that will remain will be Islam. That sounds disconcerting.
It sounds disconcerting to me. And further on in the article, if you read what I mentioned in context, nothing different than, Christians saying that we believe that God's kingdom will ultimately be established. And I honestly don't remember that particular quote, but I certainly don't think, I never believe that Islam would be the only religion. That's just against our theology. And our theology doesn't teach that. And I want people to realize, I think, the context of what I meant when democracy in this terms, for us as Muslims, God is the determinant of law. He's the one that makes what makes something prohibited and legal and illegal, for instance, drinking of alcohol. I meant in that context, if American people can say that we believe that communism is going to end, American people say that. And I'm saying, what I was saying is that man's laws will fail and ultimately God's law will prevail. That's the context that I meant. I didn't mean that, Americans are going to be destroyed and democratic system like that are going to be destroyed. And I would like to see the context of which I said that. And I want to also say, Tom, that I admit that I've grown, and I think sometimes, our rhetoric is a bit harsh.
Imam Wahaj, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation, also joining us from New York, is Robert Dannen. He's professor at NYU's Metropolitan Studies Department. He's author of Black Pilgrimage to Islam. Good evening and welcome, Robert Dannen.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks very much for joining us. Robert Dannen, you have followed the black Muslim movement over the years and no doubt followed Imam Siraj Wahaj fairly closely. Put this in context for us. What's happening here? Do we see a kind of convergence of Islamic strands of the population of the United States going on?
Imam Siraj was actually one of the first Muslims that I met back in the mid-'80s when I began to do my study. What I think that you should understand and your listeners should understand is that there's always been a convergence between the indigenous Muslim population, who I call from by rule of thumb new Muslims, and immigrant Muslims who are new Americans. And I think that Imam Siraj, as well as dozens of other American imams across the country and across North America, are respected by Muslim immigrants. More so today than at any time, and I'll tell you why. It's because of his experience and ability to confront social questions of longstanding historical significance, issues that some new Americans might not fully understand. The coalition of African-American leadership and Muslim immigrants goes back a long way. I first witnessed it in the support lent by immigrants to Jesse Jackson's 1988 presidential campaign. So, coalition building is nothing new to American politics. How Americans promote their interests politically.
The imam says
to ally themselves with African Americans depends on different historical and geographical conditions.
The imam says the Nation of Islam is receding, and that more Orthodox Islam is becoming the norm even among African American and other Muslims in the United States. Do you share that view?
Well, that's what my book is about. My book is a history of Orthodox Islam in the United States, and it goes back to the period that antedates the rise of the Nation of Islam. It goes back to the beginning of the 20th century, and there were also roots right at the beginning of the history of this republic.
So does that mean if you look some decade or two or three forward that we're going to see essentially Orthodox Islam as the Islam of the United States? And does that mean Sunni Islam? Does that mean Wahhabist Islam?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure what you mean by Wahhabist Islam. I don't know if there's a Wahhabi Central Coordinating Committee somewhere. I think that might be a misnomer that Barrett leads his readers to accept. I think that there will be one Islam, but as with Christianity and Judaism, there are many different branches, many different beliefs, many different local communities with different historical and geographical and economic needs.
I guess part of what I'm asking there, and I'll put it to Imam Wahaj as well, let me turn to you, Imam. You studied in Saudi Arabia. You know, Americans have been reading a lot about Islam in Saudi Arabia and some very fiery anti-Western, anti-American preaching coming out of there. If American Islam goes in the Orthodox direction, does it necessarily take on a kind of controversial or oppositional stance to the U.S. government, to the U.S. status quo?
Tom, you're saying a lot of things, but let me set the record straight. We weren't influenced by any Wahhabism Islam. I mean, there's no such thing. And again,
excuse me, there's no such thing as Wahhabi.
There's no such thing as Wahhabi Islam. Exactly what I said. It is Islam. It is Western media that's trying to portray that Islam, Imam Siraj, African American Muslims in America are influenced by Saudi Arabia. Not a fact.
We learned very basic
things in Saudi Arabia. 4 months. What did we learn? We learned the Arabic language.
Mm-hmm.
What did we learn? We learned something about Islamic law.
Mm-hmm.
We don't come away with the culture of the people of Saudi Arabia. Islam can be identified by also culture. So the culture, let me be straight with you. In mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia, a Muslim woman cannot drive a car. In America, she can fly a plane. We have no problem with that. We understand that. We understand where we are. But the fact of the matter is, while we were in Saudi Arabia, none of my teachers were even Saudis. They were from Egypt. They were from Sudan. And they were from Pakistan. And what did we learn? We learned very, very basic principles of Islam. Had nothing to do with this extremist Islam. We preach against extremism. The Quran teaches against extremism. Prophet Muhammad taught against extremism. And all the Muslims know that. Again, Tom, mm-hmm. when you read the Wall Street Journal, when Muslims read that and they say, look at this, they know that that's falsehood. They know that we're not influenced by Saudi Arabia. Not at all. Not in the least.
Robert Dannon, how about that? I mean, the Paul Barrett's piece is just one tiny bit of writing here. We've heard from many many folks from the Mideast and in the American scholarly community over the last months. We know that Saudi Arabia has had a big program of exporting support for Islam, and why not? That's its right. But that Wahhabism has been part of that very often. Do you agree with the Imam that there's no stamp of that on American Islam?
I think that the Imam is right. I think that you're putting him into a corner here, and you're doing it without having established the historical context for what's going on here. So if you would permit me, I can maybe give the listeners a little bit of perspective on this.
Give it to us straight and quick.
Okay. The idea that African Americans, whether they're Muslim or Christian or whatever, would become the willing dupes of foreign subversion or terrorist violence, if you want to call it that, it's been circulating since paranoid slave masters feared rebellion anytime a stranger arrived on the plantation. Okay, the same argument was the source of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. It was used by the Confederate planters when former slaves and free blacks joined the Union Army.
So when you see the current criticism,
when reality of free people exercising their rights intimidated Congress into the Compromise of 1877.
Mm-hmm.
During World War I, it was the Germans. During World War II, the Japanese, who allegedly had spies recruiting an African-American Fifth Column.
And you see that repeating itself here.
It's no coincidence. Yes, it's no coincidence that Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and many Black Panthers were brutally murdered during the Vietnam War, when anyone who militantly defended civil and human rights was branded as a communist and targeted for elimination.
Robert Dannon, we've got it loud and clear. We've got to take a break here. We thank you for joining us tonight. Robert Dannon, NYU's Metropolitan Studies Department, author of Black Pilgrimage to Islam. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Imam Siraj Wahaj about Islam in America, its growing reach, and its tensions with the American status quo. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you hear in the message of Imam Siraj Wahaj? American Muslims, does this Imam speak for you? And what is the future of Islam in America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Imam Siraj Wahaj, we had to let Robert Dannon go because we have a lot of callers who want to join us here.
Okay.
We want to hear more from you, but I was sorry to have to let him go so soon. Do you think he's got it right? Let me just ask you.
He's got it absolutely right.
He says there's a repeated pattern here.
I wish I were as articulate as he was. Yes, he's absolutely correct.
that, and so you're in that, you're saying, of course, I'm hoping to speak to a larger Islamic community here tonight, but he's looking at black Americans and saying that this is a repeated pattern. When they reach out for this, they're knocked down and
said... You
know,
exactly. You know, Tom, there's two interesting verses in the Quran, and one of them speaks about our universality, that God says that this ummah is one ummah, this nation is one nation.
Ummah being the Islamic community?
The Islamic community, mm-hmm. that is the 1,500,000,000 Muslims around the world, is a brotherhood. On the one hand, but on the other hand, Allah also says that He made us into nations and tribes to know each other. So we have some peculiarities as African Americans. But as so on the one hand, we are concerned about our own special interests, and then number two, we also concerned about the interests of the Muslims throughout the world, and also we're concerned about our interests as Americans. And I don't want you to lose that. I don't want your listeners to lose that, because you're focusing on something, the tension between. The American authorities, but on the one hand, but what about us trying to make our neighborhoods better?
Absolutely.
So those kinds of things. I don't want you to lose that.
I don't want to lose that at all. But it is that funny tension. I mean, in this big Wall Street Journal piece, for example, on many fronts you're lauded, but then there's language here that comes up and makes people say, what does that mean? And we're just trying to probe that tonight.
Okay.
Mom, if you will, I'd like to invite our callers into this conversation.
Certainly.
Alan is calling from Wilmington, North Carolina. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you for having me on, and I've been very interested in listening to this conversation. I did want to get the imam's, perspective on what Robert Dannon said about African-American leaders during the Vietnam War being targeted for murder, and I think I'm quoting him correctly. If I'm not mistaken, and what I know is that from what I've heard is Malcolm X was targeted and murdered in internecine strife by fellow Muslims. And so I don't know how Robert Dannon then says that, you know, somehow the implication was that it was the establishment that targeted and eliminated him.
Yeah, that was the implication.
I think there's an interesting book, I think it's called The Plot, The Judas Factor, The Plot to Assassinate Malcolm X. And the author talked about while African-American Muslims in the Nation of Islam, while they might have pulled the trigger, but certainly not without the knowledge of the FBI. And certainly if you read his book, I think, I just can't remember the author's name, but there's another book written by Claiborne that made the same kinds of suggestions, that the implication, and there's other books written about the implication of the FBI in the assassination of Martin Luther King.
But there was clearly tension within the black community right there as well.
Yes, there was. No, there's no doubt about it. The three people, by the way, who were accused of killing Malcolm, I know all of them. Since then, all of them have become Orthodox Muslims. Two of them definitely had nothing to do with the assassination of Malcolm X, for sure. One of them admitted it and even gave the name of those who really committed the act. And you got to also remember that at that time, the Nation of Islam was infiltrated with FBI agents. And that's a known fact.
A complicated story there. But Alan, thank you for raising it. Stan's calling from Blackstone, Massachusetts. Hi, Stan. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you all doing?
Very well, thanks.
I've got a question for the imam. Actually, let me preface this by saying I am not a member of the Islamic faith, but I have read the Quran.
Good.
And I would like to ask you, imam, a larger question.
Okay.
If it's possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Quran, as you and I both know, that the Quran is full of reassuringly beautiful passages, but it also has a lot of warnings in it, too.
Yes, uh-huh.
And one of them in the chapter called The Spider says specifically, and I'm talking about those people who are involved in what is called the holy jihad, because jihad by itself simply means a personal struggle for enlightenment with your creator.
Absolutely.
But the holy jihad is something larger than that. And it says here, it warns in The Spider chapter, he that fights for Allah's cause fights for himself. Allah does not need his creature's help. Why have we not heard more criticism of the holy jihad by Muslims throughout the world, whether black Americans, Bosnians, Southeast Asians, or whatever?
And Stan, when you say holy jihad, what exactly are you referring to?
Stan, I just want to, I have to correct you, because there's no such thing, as you know, if you read the Quran in Arabic or English, there's no such thing as holy jihad. But we must admit that yes, the Quran, yes, it talks about what we would call a just war. Certainly it does. Allah said in the Quran, fight against those who fight against you. Even then, do not go beyond the boundaries, for God loved not those who go beyond the boundaries.
Right.
So there has to be a legitimate war declared by the head of an Islamic state, not crazy, fanatical people saying that I don't like this government, I think that these people are wrong, and I'm going to take it upon myself to fight them.
But Stan's asking, if I may, Stan, you're saying, why hasn't there been more criticism of this terrorism from the Islamic community? Is that a fair characterization?
That's right, because it's...
Stan, but the problem is that it has been. But the problem is the media doesn't highlight it. We're always backed in the corner. What do you Muslims say about that? And we say it's wrong. We declare, we talk about it all the time. We talk about it in our sermons. Paul Barrett would tell you, if he attends some of my sermons and others, we criticize that. And by the way, and I don't want to say this again, I have criticized the Saudi government, and so have many Muslims. So again, you know, this whole idea is that we somehow being co-opted by the Saudi government, and they're telling, and we're doing their bidding. That's nonsense.
Stan, thanks for your call. I want to get another call here. Mansoor is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Mansoor, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks a lot. I guess I really only have a comment and a quick one at that.
Okay.
I think it's that, from what I've heard so far, it seems almost like trying to categorize Muslims as though they're very, very homogenous whole, you know?
Well, I hope we don't do that, but we're just trying to get some new insight here from the imam.
Well, I know the imam. I am a Muslim, and I've heard him speak. And traditionally, that's kind of what I've seen coming across.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like there's always a lot of acknowledgement that there's a whole spectrum of beliefs, you know? That, like, you know, you may accept part of Islamic beliefs, but not all of them, you know? So I guess I just wanted to make that clear.
And within that spectrum, Mansoor, where would you place Imam Siraj Wahaj?
Well, I would say that, I mean, I'd still say he's quite a bit conservative, but in a progressive sort of way, you know? Like, he holds to some traditions, but he's starting, I think, to acknowledge the diversity in America, but not to the extent that it's actually taking place, you know? Like, I just graduated from college, and a lot of my friends have a very, I guess, you would almost call them radical ideas, you know, in terms of conservative Islam. They're very different. They're very new ways of thinking.
You mean non-conservative ideas?
Non-conservative ideas, you know?
Mansoor, stick with this. Imam Siraj Wahaj, what do you say to that?
Oh, I want to say that, yes, because, you know, Muslims are not a monolith. And, you know, I have seen Muslim women in this country have the traditional scarves, and even face veils, and other Muslims who don't wear scarves at all. I lecture in colleges and universities, you know, almost daily, and we see this divergence of Islamic view. And, you know, so we have that, and I do agree with Brother Mansoor. And I do want to say this, is that I agree with my brother Hamza Yusuf, a good friend of mine, in that all of us are growing. I think we've grown not only since 9/11, but in terms of my own journey, I feel that I've grown from the days of the Nation of Islam. One of the things that I've learned as having been a member of the Nation of Islam is that how much I thought I knew then and how much I've grown. And I would hope to think that I haven't stopped growing. And as Jesse Jackson has said, that God is still working on me.
Mansoor, thanks for your call. Imam, we have just 1 minute left.
Yes.
Do you see ultimately a conflict between American culture as you see it today and Islam as you teach it?
There are some conflicts, you know, but I think we definitely can live together in peace and harmony. And I think that Christians and Jews and Muslims and all of us will have our impact on the society. And we think that we add to make America better. That's what I see. I see us not fighting the American people, but in fact living in harmony with others as we have done historically in many places, including Spain. And I see us doing that now.
Imam Siraj Wahaj, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
Imam Siraj Wahaj is head of the Masjid al-Taqwa Mosque in Brooklyn, New York, one of the most prominent lecturers in the American Muslims speaking circuit these days. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a single 20-something woman celebrates Ramadan in San Francisco. This is On Point. For the past 2 weeks, Muslims around the world have been fasting from dawn to dusk in observation of Ramadan, the holiest month of the Islamic calendar. San Francisco Muslim Asma Hassan says a month's worth of planning meals around sunrise and sunset is hard enough, but being far away from family and a culture that cherishes Ramadan make things even more difficult. In this radio diary, Asma Hassan says being an urban American 20-something Muslim gives Ramadan an entirely new meaning.
I'm not celebrating Ramadan the way my mother did in Pakistan, or even the way I did as a child in Colorado. My mom's Ramadan dining table was filled with South Asian delicacies. She and her brothers, sister, and parents would gather just before sunset to open their fasts for the iftar meal. Freshly fried onion fritters with mint chutney, spicy lamb chops with tamarind and plum chutney, soft, hot, doughy naans, as well as fried tortilla-type bread called pratas. Chicken tikka with another kind of bread called chapatis, pudding made of carrots grown on my grandfather's farm, and other sweet dishes called halva. My mother and her siblings would sit before this grand table, eyeing the items that my grandmother had spent the whole day preparing and whose scent filled their home. For me, this same rite of opening the fast includes warming leftover pasta in my microwave. If I'm feeling spunky, I might order Indian food for delivery. My dinner companion is Alex Trebek, hosting Jeopardy. I pray by myself and then decide whether or not to go to the gym. The only scent filling my apartment is from my neighbor's evening cigar. If I were married, as I should have been 10 years ago under Pakistani cultural standards, I would not be opening my fast alone. And this Ramadan, like me, many Gen X Muslim women are also fasting alone. According to statistics compiled by the Islamic Society of North America, American Muslim women in their 20s and 30s outnumber Muslim men in the same age group 2-to-1. Ramadan is family time. My mother and her family, for instance, after eating the feast at iftar, would pray together and then have another meal, dinner, together, where they would discuss the day's events and plan the next day's fast. One of the purposes behind Ramadan is to learn what suffering feels like, to experience what those who are hungry do every day. Waking up alone in the early morning hours, by myself, in the dark, to eat a pre-dawn breakfast is not easy. When I fast at my parents' home, I usually have a family member to cajole or entertain me, or my mother will simply stay up all night just to make sure that I wake up in time, and then she'll make me her own version of her mother's feast. But to fast alone, to fast single, makes the process more alienating than it already is. Eating eggs and burnt toast at 5 a.m., watching a Saudi Malvi recite the Quran on cable, is a far cry from the eventful Ramadan gatherings my mother told me about when I was little. Ramadan single is perhaps, in a way, reaching a truer meaning of Ramadan. Although families observe Ramadan as a unit, Ramadan is actually not meant to be fun. Ramadan alone is more suffering than Ramadan together. It can make you more sympathetic to the plight of those who are hungry and helpless and alone. For those who fast the full 30 days with sincerity, great rewards are promised. Hopefully, for single Muslim women, a mate will be one of them.
Asma Hassan is a writer and law firm associate. Her new book, Why I Am a Muslim, will be published in March. She lives in San Francisco. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.